This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Let's wade into the swamp of climate illusions with Australia author David Spratt. Then Aussie radio host Vivian Langford takes us to the courthouse. Kids and grannies block trains to the world's largest coal port. Hear the living voices of activists and why they risk so much to save our climate.
Radio EcoShock.
What if we really have wrecked the planet, with massive casualties coming in the next generation? That would be really inconvenient. But get ready for authority to soothe you again about the real risk of extreme climate change. The awful facts and witnesses are all lined up by our next guest. David Spratt is best known as the author of the book and blog Climate Code Red. He is with the Breakthrough National Center for Climate Restoration in Australia. And I spoke with David on Radio EcoShock in 2014 and 2016. Since then, he and co-author Ian Dunlop have updated their devastating critique of climate science called What Lies Beneath? The Inside Story of Political Failure and Scientific Reticence on Climate Change's Existential Risks. From Melbourne, David, welcome back to the program.
Thank you, Alex. Great to be with you and your community of listeners.
Yes, your update to What Lies Beneath has a foreword by a person I think is one of the godlike figures of climate science, Germany's Professor Hans-Joachim Schellenhuber. He's the founding director of the famous Potsdam Institute, among other things. So Schellenhuber writes, quote, climate change is now reaching the end game where very soon humanity must choose between taking unprecedented action or accepting that it has been left too late and bear the consequences. Now, David, I'm in the camp that I think we're already at or past that critical decision point, and it has been left too late. What do you think?
Well, look, I think Schellenhuber's voice is really important. As you say, he's one of the eminent climate scientists in the world and perhaps the world's most politically connected. He is advisor to the European Union, to Chancellor Merkel, and indeed has spent a lot of time with Pope Francis. So his voice has a great deal of authority. And the fact that he wrote the foreword to our book is important because it says to the rest of the scientific community, as he says in his foreword, that what we're saying is correct. And as non-scientists, it's always difficult to intervene and write about the science community in a critical way. So I think that's important. Look, he has used the phrase endgame, which I think is really pertinent. We know in chess that means that you are close to the end and some big decisions have got to be made and there's not a lot of moves left on the board, and that's absolutely correct. If we really threw everything at this, if we thought that this was an emergency in the way that we deal with floods and fires and actually put the normal working of society a bit to one side to deal with the problem, I think we could probably get out of it. But the way the political process is going at the moment, one can't be too optimistic.
So going the way we are going, what kind of warming over pre-industrial times do you expect by 2050 or 2100?
Well, look, I think the first step in that is to look at the Paris Agreement in 2015, which was widely lauded at the time. I think since then people have become more sanguine and slightly depressed about the process. And the Paris voluntary unenforceable commitments by nations at the moment would add up to around 3.4 degrees of warming. But what we must understand is that, and this is the problem with the IPCC report, that figure does not include any of the carbon cycle feedbacks, the weakening of some of our climate systems such as permafrost and Amazon land-based stores of carbon. If those feedbacks are taken into account, it's probably closer to 5. So on the Paris course, we're heading to somewhere between 3.5 and 5. Will we do better or worse than that? That's another question.
That's pretty worrying. All right. Now, I'd like to go through a few of the signs of institutional blindness that you list in the What Lies Beneath report. For example, Schellenhuber starts with the probability obsession. What is that?
This comes to really the core issue here. And if we look at the work of the IPCC over more than 20 years, which is really an assembly of individual pieces of climate research, from the beginning, the IPCC has always had a bias towards what climate models, computer models of the climate think. Now, those models are far from perfect. One of the things they cannot do is properly model what are called non-linear changes in the system, where parts of our climate system, whether it be ice in the Antarctic, whether it be permafrost, whether it be the Amazon or something else, system change very rapidly. So the models that the IPCC use are always conservative, and they do not deal with those big non-linear events. And the other option is to learn from history, because we have a very rich history of our climate in the study of paleoclimatology. And that would tell us that, for example, at the moment we have 410 parts per million of CO2 in the atmosphere. That's 50% higher than it's been in the last million years. And IPCC science would say, oh, well, look, that's heading towards 2 degrees. But if you look at the paleoclimate work, and we look back in history, the last time we had this amount of carbon dioxide in the air, which was 3.5 million years ago in a period called the mid-Pliocene, warming was 3 to 4 degrees above pre-industrial and sea levels are 25 metres higher. So the essence of the problem is that the IPCC process downplays and ignores our climate history in favour of models which are not adequate to deal with future changes in the climate system.
Well, sure. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the IPCC, it was founded in 1988 to advise governments on climate change. How have their predictions and assessments held up over time?
Well, in the short term, they haven't been too bad, but they've always been a bit on the conservative side of reality. We had an economist, Ross Garnaut, here in Australia, who was commissioned by the then Labor government in 2007 to 2010 to do some work on carbon trading and policy. And he wrote a devastating critique in one of his reports where he said reality, the climate change reality, is always on one side of the predictions. And if in any science the observations are not in the middle of the predictions, it means the predictions are too conservative. And that is now well understood by both scientists and commentators. I mean, one of the really great examples is that, I mean, for a long time in policy-making terms, and the IPCC is not just science, it's politically influenced science. I mean, for example, until Paris talked about 1.5 degrees of warming as a target, the IPCC actually hadn't documented the paths or the impacts of 1.5 degrees. So the IPCC actually followed the politicians into looking at that. But we've always accepted that 2 degrees would be a reasonable target. And yet we now have circumstances where, in a paper, perhaps you have already talked about in your program, the paper on Hothouse Earth, which came out a month or so ago, where scientists said that if you get to 2 degrees, you may trigger feedback from the system that will take warming much higher, for example, towards 3 degrees. So even getting close to 2 degrees might trigger, if not runaway warming, accelerated warming that would move beyond the capacity of human action to slow it down. So I think the scientists, whether it be Sheldon Hoover in the Fortier Report or others, are increasingly concerned that the IPCC is too conservative. Many of them are privately saying that the coming 1.5 degree report will be so conservative as to be, in my terms, a political fix. So that's the problem we're looking at.
Well, I always remind myself when I'm reading an IPCC report that somehow oil-dependent governments like the U.S. and Canada and Saudi Arabia all agreed to the wording line by line. And, you know, should we really depend on Saudi Arabia for our climate policy? I don't think so.
This is exactly the point. The original big volume reports are put together by scientists, and I think they in themselves are conservative and reticent because they're run by modellers. They have an eye to the political issues, I think. But when you get to the summaries that come out of the IPCC report, called the some of his policymakers, they are actually voted on sentence by sentence by diplomatic representatives of the 180 or 90 countries who represent the IPCC. And yes, the United States, Russia, Saudi Arabia can veto line by line what those reports say. So the SPMs are incredibly conservative. And there's actually some stories around at the moment that for the coming 1.5 degree report, it may not come out in an SPM form. It's due on Monday week because the Saudis and the Americans are just sitting on their hands. So this is politically mediated science communication.
Where I live in Canada, it's frozen. A lot of Canada is frozen, and there's organic material from ages past frozen in there with it. It's like an ice box full of old food. And once that starts to thaw, there's going to be a stink, as gases like methane and carbon dioxide, which doesn't smell, but they're all released. And you have a whole section in your report, What Lies Below, on permafrost. Why?
Because this is one of the stories that's not being told. The IPCC reports, for example, give us carbon budgets about how much carbon we can burn for various degrees of warming. And none of those budgets consider that the permafrost will become active and release, as you say, carbon dioxide and methane to the atmosphere, which would reduce the amount of budget if the climate system is becoming less efficient at holding carbon either in the oceans or in the land. They assume that is not active, and yet we have clear evidence that it already is. So this is a systemic underestimation of the problem. And you know, there's credible science saying that in the next 10 or 20 years, the release of greenhouse gases from the permafrost could be sufficient. And once it starts, it basically becomes self-generating and self-sustaining. It could become enough to negate half of the world's land carbon sink at the moment. So this is just one of those hidden issues that really undermine the far too conservative estimates that on which policymakers are making their decisions.
Yes, I have a new interview with the French scientist now in Austria, Thomas Gasser, and he's just published a paper in Nature Geoscience in September, and it says that the amount of greenhouse gases coming out of the permafrost is really dependent on the emissions path that humans take. But he does say that permafrost has already begun to thaw, and he cannot see any way that it can be stopped once started. And that's just one tipping point, isn't it? What are some others?
Well, look, the climate system stores carbon in a number of places. Obviously, it stores it in permafrost, which is frozen carbon-rich material. It stores it in the ocean. The carbon dioxide in the atmosphere mixes with the ocean and is drawn down. It's obviously stored in trees and all plants who undergo photosynthesis and take down carbon dioxide, and it's actually stored in the ground as well, whether it be through particular farming practices or other forms that store soil carbon. Now, all of those processes are not fixed. They are all changeable, and we've just talked about permafrost. We already have evidence in the Amazon, which is, you know, a very large store of carbon, that with climate change, parts of the Amazon are drying, it's getting less rainfall, you're getting more wildfires in the Amazon, and the capacity of the Amazon to store carbon is decreasing. We also know as the oceans warm, their capacity to store carbon dioxide is reduced. So these are some of the issues that are really not incorporating the thinking about where warming might go. And the other issue, of course, is that parts of the climate system are what we might call linear. If there's more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, we know the temperature will go up. As the temperature goes up, for every 1 degree, the atmosphere will store 7% more water vapour, so you can get heavier rainfalls. As the atmosphere warms, you can get stronger winds and hence stronger cyclones, and not necessarily more of them. So they're linear responses, which are well understood by the models, but there are non-linear events where elements of the climate system literally flip from one state to another. A great example is the West Antarctic ice sheet, where early IPCC reports said this will be stable for 1,000 years. And that was generally accepted. And yet in 2014, we had a report coming out by Eric Rigneau and his fellow researchers saying, we think that some of the glaciers in West Antarctica have already passed their tipping point and no further perturbation or heating the system would be necessary to produce a 2 to 5 meter sea level rise. Now, these nonlinear events, a bit like the triggering of permafrost, you can't see in advance, but once they happen, you can say, yes, I can see when it happened. And this is the problem, because these are not things that can be easily modeled or predicted, and it means we should be very precautionary in how we think about climate change and its future risks.
This is Radio EcoShock. I am Alex with my guest, Australian author and climate activist David Spratt. We're talking about Climate Code Red and the report What Lies Beneath. You have a new blog post. Well, it's an updated blog post titled IPCC's Political Fix on 1.5 Degrees C Will Undermine Its Credibility. What's the report and what is the problem with it?
The report was commissioned out of the Paris Agreement. In 2015, policymakers got together, and under pressure from the small island states, what's called the High Ambition Group, rather than just saying we should aim for 2 degrees of warming or less, which has been the traditional position of policymakers, they said 1.5 to 2 degrees. And then they asked the IPCC to produce a report on 1.5 degrees. And that report is due on the 8th of October. The problem is it's trying to fit a square peg into a round hole, because we know, for example, that we have no carbon budget left for 1.5 degrees. We already have more than 1.5 degrees in the system right now without putting another tonne of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And it's also arguable with the sort of feedbacks that we're talking about that there's no carbon budget left for 2 degrees either, which are a very sobering propositions, because without large amounts of carbon drawdown, we're heading to a very bad place. But the IPCC report is trying to fudge these issues and produce carbon budget figures that literally don't exist. They're doing that by using too lower a climate sensitivity, which is a measure of how much the system warms with a given amount of release of greenhouse gases. They're doing it by not looking at the last 3 years of accelerated warming in their temperature baseline and so on. And there have been a lot of scientists who have seen the reports just tearing their hair out and saying to us, I can't say it really publicly until the report comes out, but saying, we think that this report will maybe even destroy the credibility of the IPCC because it's become too political. And that's before Saudi Arabia, the United States and their friends get to vote on the summary for policymakers. So there's growing evidence concern that the politicisation of science has destroyed the IPCC's credibility.
Right. If you want to get steam coming out of my ears, just start telling me about all the gigatons of carbon we can keep on burning in the coming decades.
That's right.
I think it's just so delusional.
Look, Alex, I think the other thing you need to think about, and it's the point you make in the first part of our report, is how we think about risk. You and I know that in engineering today, whether it be an aeroplane or a bridge, we have very low tolerances for failure. I mean, you wouldn't have, an aeroplane has got a whatever it is, a 1 in a million chance of falling out of the sky in its lifetime or in every 10 years. We don't drive or walk across a bridge if we think there's a 1 in 10 chance of the bridge collapsing while we're on it. We are very risk averse. Yet if you think about climate policy, you know, we keep on hearing these things saying, oh, we've got so much carbon budget for a 50% chance or a 67% chance not exceeding 2 degrees. And everybody says, oh, well, that's okay. What they don't understand when somebody says we've got a 50% chance of not exceeding, for example, 3 degrees, is you actually in that have a 10% chance of exceeding 6 degrees, which is the end of human civilization. So in the way we think about risk and climate change, we're not adopting the precautionary approach to risk management we do in every other aspect of our life.
And also really obscene to me, what is overshooting the climate? What's the plan there?
Well, this is a sort of, I would say, a political fix that came out of the Paris Agreement, because Paris, under political pressure quite rightly, from the small island states and others, said we should try and keep warming to 1.5. Now, 1.5 degrees is really not safe. I mean, we have one of the great wonders of the natural world in Australia, the Great Barrier Reef. Up till 3 years ago, half of that had been lost. through a variety of factors, and then extremely unusually warm waters around the Barrier Reef over the last 3 years actually reduced its area by half again. So the Great Barrier Reef is now down to a quarter of its size 30 years ago. And we have research from here in Melbourne, where I'm based, saying that those waters we had 3 years ago, the chance of that happening in the future, just at the current level of warming, is about 1 year in three. So the reef is likely to bleach 1 year in three, and it takes 15 years for coral to recover. So this is the death spiral for coral reefs everywhere at the current warming of 1.1. So 1.5 is not safe. Perhaps half a degree is safe, as Jim Hansen has been saying for two decades. But they had that 1.5 degree target in Paris, and then they try to show how you could get the world to 1.5 degrees of warming. Rather than saying we've already passed it, what they said was, well, we can keep on emitting greenhouse gases for another 30, 40, 50 years, and then in the second half of the century, we'll draw all those excess gases down by, I think, called bioenergy, these carbon capture and storage, BECCS, which means that you pump large amounts of liquid carbon dioxide back into the oil and gas wells where the fossil fuels came from. But that scenario is not 1.5. It means going towards 2 degrees of warming and then trying to get back down. So when they say here's a 1.5 scenario, what they're really saying is here's a 2 degree scenario that we hope we can get back down to 1.5. But people don't understand that overshoot idea when they hear these figures.
So let me get this straight. The official plan, agreed by over 190 governments, is to load up our atmosphere with enough carbon to blow up our climate and then hope our kids can fix it.
To get us to 2 degrees, which might be a hothouse earth and feedbacks kicking in that will take us much higher, yes.
And then our kids are supposed to fix it.
And then we fix it by a technology called BECCS, which bioenergy, which the fossil fuel industry love, because it produces a market in liquid carbon dioxide as large as the current fossil fuel oil and gas market. So it's their money future. But that technology does not exist at scale, has not been proven, and is probably going to be very expensive. I mean, we do know that there are ways now to get carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. Some researchers in Melbourne have shown that the restoration of degraded forests is by far the most effective and cheapest way to start doing that task now. But that's not being funded to the degree that it should. So, yes, we are deferring the problem so that a business-as-normal economic model can proceed for the next few decades.
I've just looked into that, and we've had guests who say, yes, tropical forests, they are a carbon-sucking machine, but we've had record deforestation in 2016 and 2017, so we're going the wrong way on that one.
Well, we've got deforestation, and then we've got the weakening of forests due to climate change, so there's two processes at work there. But, I mean, the opportunity is there to change this. I mean, in parts of the developing world, deforestation is an economic imperative, to put it mildly, particularly when a country is owned by the military and they get the whole of the land if they want with it. But I mean, it is certainly true that if sufficient revenue is put into those countries to give them another alternative, they wouldn't do it.
Well, there are a few scientists shouting out about our dire situation, and I've had some on the program, Michael Mann, Kevin Anderson, and others. They call for the three levers approach. Now, we don't have a lot of time, but could you briefly just point to what those three levers are, David?
Well, look, they say, first of all, carbon dioxide, which stays in the atmosphere for a long time. When we put carbon dioxide up there, a quarter of it's still there in 1,000 years' time. We have simply got to stop emitting carbon dioxide to make the problem worse. That's the first lever. The second lever is that we put a lot of what are called more short-lived gases, things like methane, which lasts 10 years, nitrous oxide, which lasts 100 years. We're putting them up in the atmosphere. If we stop them, then we would actually reduce the amount of heat in the system. So that's really important. So that's the second lever, the short-lived gases. And the third lever is to find the means for the deforestation, soil carbon at large scale or new processes which we can innovate to reduce the amount of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So the three levers are stop carbon dioxide production, lever number two, reduce the short-lived gases, draw down the gases.
we are allegedly really intelligent. Can't humans just adapt to this coming warmer world?
Past a certain point, no. We've spent a lot of time over the last 18 months looking at what are called the existential risk, is a risk which would essentially bring human civilization to a change as we know it. Now, Professor Kevin Anderson, who you interviewed, is on the record as saying that, that 4 degrees of warming would be incompatible with the maintenance of human civilization. Professor Sheldon Huber, who we talked about earlier, who wrote the Fortier report several years ago, said if you got to 4 degrees of warming, the carrying capacity of the planet would probably be 1 billion people. And this is well understood. I mean, in fact, there's now work out saying if you got to 3 degrees of warming, you'd be in serious existential risk. I mean, think about it, 25, 30 metres of sea level rise. How many nations would disappear? 1 metre of sea level rise will flood 20% of Bangladesh, 30 million people. 1 level of sea level rise will flood half the Mekong Valley, which is Vietnam's food source. 1 metre of sea level rise will take out a large number of coastal cities around the world. So it is clear that in the 3 to 4 degree range, we are talking about the end of human civilization as we know it. And yet the Paris Agreement, as we discussed earlier, is currently a warming range of 3 to 5 degrees. So we are on course for, if not the complete end of human civilization, changes to which would make our society now unrecognizable in 100 years' time.
Well, here's what I want to know. Should I still take my dream trip to Greece or buy a heavier pickup truck?
I think you should sit on top of a mountain and take a whole lot of CEOs from the world's leading countries and sit there until you think about it deeply and for a long time, and they see the light coming out of the mountain then the next morning.
Yes, you see, my question was half serious because we are so straddled between a pretty comfortable present for most of us and a surreal future that you and I have been talking about somewhere over the cliff. It's enough to drive us crazy, and I wonder if we're not starting to experience a kind of pre-climate stress disorder.
Look, we are, and psychologists are pointing to that. Even in Australia, we've had a very severe drought in eastern Australia, which has affected a lot of our farming community, and the suicide rate goes up. I mean, this is, in part, a climate warming-driven health impact. So that is true. I mean, I think there's almost a psychological feedback that because the climate policy-making system is so wedded to a business-as-usual approach, not accepting that we actually face an emergency, need emergency action, the worse the problem gets, the more policymakers want to ignore it because it would actually upset the apple cart, the policy-making apple cart which they sit in. So, yes, I think those processes are at work. And the real issue is that whether it's in politics or in business, our time horizons have shortened from decades to years over a recent period. I mean, businesses used to think 20, 30 years ahead. Now they have 3-year investment horizons. It's the short-term nature of things which is really our enemy.
David Spratt, you've been ringing the code red alarm for some years now. What keeps you at it?
Well, people say climate change is all about fear or hope. You know, should we be positive and just say it's all right and look at renewable energy or be drowned by the fear? I don't think it's either. I think what probably keeps me going, you going, is the courage to speak the truth to the circumstances we face, because we know this is going to have a devastating effect on both human and natural systems, and that's something that's so morally disturbing that we just can't sit by.
Right. Do you have any new projects to tell us about or final thoughts as we wrap up here?
Well, look, I think one of the interesting things is we've been thinking a little bit how you talk about climate change to conservatives, because obviously in Australia, a very large fossil fuel producing nation, of our 5 main exports, they are in order roughly iron ore, gas, overseas tourism, and foreign students flying into Australia. So we're very fossil fuel dependent, and we're very partisan politics, as there has been, is in the United States and has been in Canada. And I think it's really interesting to think about climate change and pitching climate change not as an economic opportunity, not framing it as a green or environmental issue, which I think has been disastrous in terms of creating partisan politics, but actually to talk in the way we have. The duty of the government is to protect the people. The people are now going to suffer an existential threat. And what are those consequences? So it's not an economic debate. It's not a green versus non-green debate. It's a debate about whether human civilization will survive. And we have found that that discussion has been quite effective in engaging conservatives more than some of the traditional framings.
From Melbourne, Australia, we've been talking with author and climate writer David Spratt. You can find his work at climatecodered.org and look for his report with Ian Dunlop called What Lies Beneath. I will put links to all that in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. David, thank you so much for spending time again with us.
Great pleasure, and thank you very much, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Australia is one of the world's largest sources of coal. It's heading to Asia and then to the atmosphere to change the climate and our planet. A group of all ages blocked the dirty trains leading to the world's biggest coal port in Newcastle, Australia. Radio journalist Vivian Langford from Beyond Zero and 3CR Radio Melbourne takes us to the courthouse to find out why.
You knew that you were living in a huge conspiracy. Would you leave your suburbs, get out of your SUV? Would you hit the streets and fight for all our lives? Would you hold your ground when the stormtroopers arrive? If you knew that the whole planet depended on what you do now, would you take a man with the speed our times allow? If the pundits told the truth for just a week or two and real life was shown on TV, what if you knew?
Good evening, everybody. This is an extension of the Beyond Zero Emissions radio show. It reports on an issue that has not got much media. There was a very dramatic moment in September where quite a number of people, up to 40, locked onto the coal machinery, stopped the coal trains into the greatest coal port in the world, Newcastle. So I went up on the train to interview the people outside the court where they had their first mention, and I will do a further program when the court cases have all been decided. You will hear a young person who was so young that he had to be tried in the children's court, and the sentence that he got is hilarious. You listen to what he says. I was there with him and his mother, and really it just makes you gasp to think of the sentence. I'd love to be a fly on the wall when he has to be mentored by some people from the coal industry about how to protest legally or in a more appropriate manner. I'd love to hear or see the looks on their faces when he tells them what he's going to tell you now. You should listen to that because it's marvellous. Very young bloke. And then I interviewed the Knitting Nannas who were inside the court. They come from regional New South Wales, some of them from Gloucester, some of them from Newcastle and other places, and they just converged outside with their banners and their knitting and very friendly, very disarming presence. But when I talked to them, of course, they totally get the long vision, the big vision of what coal is doing to our climate. The last person on this audio is a man called Max, who was a very fiery speaker, and he had not only wanted to tell us about the group itself and the kind of dynamics within it, which is rather a new form of group. It's non-hierarchical and very inclusive. He gave his vision, and as he said, if in 100 years we don't see an enormous tapering off of the coal and other fossil fuels, where there won't be a world that's very habitable for any of us. So I hope you enjoy this program, and thank you to David Rovics for the song, and there'll be another David Rovics song at the end called Shut Them Down. I'm outside Newcastle Local Court, and I've got here one of the protesters who should be heroes in every household of Australia because they locked onto the massive coal industry machinery by looking onto the coal trains that go out to the biggest coal port in the world. And Balan is with me. He was actually tried in a different court, which was the children's court, because he must be young. So, Balan, tell us what happened there. Oh, no, first tell us what you did and why you did it.
So, on the 5th of September, I ascended a tripod over the coal line heading into Port Waratah on Kooragang Island. It's the largest coal port in the world, and it exports about upwards of 400,000 tons of coal every day. So that's affected my hometown of Newcastle my whole life, and I just went there to take a stand against that.
Did you do it because you're young and sort of risk taker, or have you been thinking about it for a long time?
So my entire life I've been quite conscious of the impending climate catastrophe that's upon us. It's something that I've contemplated for a long time. It's something that I believe I have a very strong right to be able to talk about and commentate on, because of my youth and because of how long I'm going to have to be living on this planet with those consequences.
Every time I come up here or anywhere in the Hunter Valley, just seeing those trucks, nothing seems to stop them. You can stand on a bridge and they just keep coming. And I just was so happy when I saw that you were doing this, and I interviewed the first person, Sarah, to sort of block the trains. So you were on a tripod, were you? And then what did the children's court actually say to you?
In the children's court, the judge was very, very good. She set me up with a youth justice conference with a bunch of representatives from the coal industry, so I can talk to them about how to blockade them more safely and more effectively. So, yeah, not that I believe what I did was unsafe or that the people around me were in an unsafe environment, though it gives me a platform to speak my mind and to talk directly to the people doing this damage.
Yeah, so it's an opportunity for you to get through to them.
Yeah, I definitely see it that way.
Well, I've got Balan's mother here too, and she said she was happy to see the streaming video of what he was doing. Tell us a bit about yourself, and what did you feel when you saw that, and then later the more massive lock-on?
I think these kids are being driven to do these things because our policymakers are letting us down significantly. There's so much evidence that this is an issue, and time again, nothing happens. So they're driven to, you know, they've done petitions. A lot of them are on burnout because they're just constantly protesting, constantly trying to bring it into the public eye, but it never seems to make it there. It never seems to make it into policy and into actual action to stop the problem. So to see somebody like Balan and all of the people that are involved here compromise themselves and their futures because of this situation, I take my hat off to them.
You must be quite proud of him, really. And seeing in court all these other people that have done that, it wasn't reported in the media. That's why I'm here. I've come up here from Sydney on the early, early train because I thought, I wonder if ABC's going to be there. I wonder if any radio station's going to be there or TV, and they're not. So no. What do you think about the media?
Yeah, I'm really disappointed, and I'm not surprised it doesn't make it a policy, because if it's not making it into the media, how does it make it into the public forum, and then how do we put pressure on our politicians, who are here to represent us, to do the things that are necessary to make sure there's a future for our kids? I mean, you look at kids like Balan, who has no plans to have children because he can't see a world that is going to support them.
Tragic. Say more about the media. You tell us the scene that they missed. You said to me I wasn't here. I only interviewed Sarah on the first day, but then on the Wednesday there was another tripod. That must have been Balan. Then on the Friday there was another one, and then by the end there was a Kokoda veteran in his 90s who was mentioned on Radio National. But like, it took that for the media to paid attention. But what did you see that they missed? Tell us the story.
So there was the preceding events, and then on the weekend there was an all-in. So we had knitting nanas across a road stopping entry to the coal port, checking if the police that were coming to remove them, if they wanted a cup of tea, with the wonderful sense of humour that they bring and lightness that they bring to such a serious issue. And in amongst that happening, there was, I think, 45 people on the actual coal port. But that in the media was very, very hard to find. There was a small amount of local coverage and a very, very small grab that I saw on the ABC, but it was a very, very small grab. And, you know, this is the largest coal port, and it's being stopped. And coal is a major, major amount of money coming into Australia. So why isn't this widespread news?
Maybe it's because of that money coming in. Maybe that money's brought a lot of silence there. But as you say, it's a terrific story, dramatic story. How did they do it? How did they kind of, I imagine it's all security fences and around there. How did they actually do it?
They're a well-organised group. I think they think things through, they look after the safety of everybody involved, and they try to orchestrate things as safely for everybody. Also, they specifically work with non-violent direct action. So it's not about resisting. It's just about trying to have a voice, trying to show people that here is an issue that's being ignored by the people that should be listening and should be acting.
Okay. What's your message to the politicians if we had the Prime Minister just standing here or watching on TV tonight? What would you like him to hear?
So we have opportunities for renewable energy. It's not about just dumping what we're doing now. It's about planning a way out. It's planning our way out. It's about looking at other things. It's looking at other ways of reducing the carbon emissions. It's about looking at new ways and other ways of providing the energy that we need to live, and also of providing jobs to the people that are currently in those industries.
I actually think these coal companies, even if they had a timetable, you know, you've got a decade, they'd fit in with it.
Oh, absolutely. That's right. And, you know, I mean, the companies, this is a finite resource. I imagine that they're looking at embracing other manners. So bring that forward. Bring that work forward and embrace the ways that are there and non-detrimental to our, you know, if there's no world, there's no coal, there's no jobs, there's no anything. So, yeah.
Thank you.
Radio EcoShock.
I'm in the Newcastle Courthouse and I've met up with the Knitting Nanas, who've come from various Knitting Nanas groups, and this lady here is from Gloucester. Would you like to tell me your motivation? You've made a big effort to get here. What's your motivation about this court case?
Well, I'm concerned that about climate change, as the majority of the population are. And I know that the people down here now facing court are those who've put themselves forward to tried to convince the government and also our fellow citizens that we need to be taking this very seriously. This is our one opportunity. And I think now that we have governments that are reactive rather than proactive, so therefore the more citizens that stand up and say you need to do something about climate change, to try to encourage planning towards diversification, job opportunities for people, stop the coal. There cannot be more coal, and there has to be opportunities for people who are involved in it, here in Newcastle in particular. So that's why I'm here, in order to try to raise the profile of those concerns, because governments will do what the people need. The most people need coal reduced and renewables and climate change taken notice. If that's what we demand of them, eventually they will do what gets them votes. So thank you for that opportunity.
Well, but also, just one more thing. You're from Gloucester, where I seem to remember you were going to be colonised by AGL Gas. I saw their trucks going up and down. They were doing test drilling, and your little community actually won. Just tell us, refresh our listeners. You can never tell this story too often. Just how did that happen?
Well, we got together, and we stood up for what we believe in. We refuse to believe that we can do nothing. You can do something if you all get up together and you say, and you're well informed and you speak the truth, then eventually you can do something. And so that's what we did. But there is probably other stories relating to the quality of the gas, the way it could be got out, the economics of the situation, probably things that I don't really know as much about as I'd like to, but certainly as a community, we fought very long and hard, and we would advocate for anybody else to do the same thing.
Where are you from?
I'm also from Gloucester.
Okay.
And as Peter just said, we're here because we believe that climate change is something that needs to be taken far more seriously. People need to be made far more aware of it. And we came down today to support the people who put themselves at the front line of trying to highlight this. It is to highlight it to the government, but it is also to bring it to the attention to the rest of the community.
Yes.
That must realise that how important it is and how we do have to stop coal. We need to be looking. We need to be looking towards a reasonable change towards renewables, and it needs to happen, and it needs to happen now, because it's not just it's the future of the children. It's the future for all the young people. And if we don't do something, they've got no chance.
I think that's the particular appeal of grandmothers, isn't it? Nanas and knitting, it's not offensive, it's sort of mainstream, and so people get that. But what about when you first saw pictures, perhaps in the Newcastle Herald, I don't know, it wasn't very widely reported in the paper, but I got images of these people locked on, and there was a man in his 90s who was from the Kokoda Trail era, and he also said, well, look, I haven't got much longer for this world, but I'm going to protest against coal for the future. What was your first reaction when you saw that someone, this well-organised group, was doing something?
Oh, I'm just so in awe of the people that put themselves on the line to do this.
Yeah.
And Bill Ryan is, he's a hero. He's the Nana's hero. You know, he's just there. He is such a... an inspiration to us all.
Yeah.
He is amazing. He came up to Gloucester when we were fighting AGL. Of course, you know, we still have another fight in Gloucester, the Rocky Hill coal mine. Yeah. We're just waiting for the result from the Land and Environment Court, and we're hoping for the best there. But we have to get the message to our politicians, the time for coal is over. We need that timely transition.
Okay. I'm outside Newcastle Court, and one of the people who is participating today, witnessing the court procedure, was Max. And I'd like to ask him, what's his motivation in being involved in this sort of frontline action against coal?
Yeah, thank you. So I'm involved with FLAC because I see climate change and resource extraction of fossil fuels as something that's going to wipe out most life on Earth in the next little while if we don't really start curbing its power and stopping what it's doing. I do work with FLAC because they behave in a way that is representative of a climate emergency. It's not something that can be something you do once every now and then for me. It's something that, you know, has to be total commitment because there is no second planet. There is no place for us to run away and hide on. We have a very, very short amount of time, as I said, to end the use of fossil fuels. I'm personally talking about 5 years to end fossil fuels, and you know that's a radical thing to say, but it's also you can do a lot in 5 years. The Second World War showed that with the change in industry that can happen over that time, and it's these blockages that are happening from corporate power that are preventing this change, and they are responsible for what will be a mass extinction event on this planet unless we start to be really serious. You know, our movement relies on people joining and coming to do what a lot of us are already doing. You know, we need full-time climate protectors, and that's all we need to be happening.
Well, and it's symbolic what you're doing. You're climbing onto machinery, you're stopping it symbolically. It's not losing the coal companies a huge amount of money, though they will try to argue that in court. But you will potentially up for terrible charges, years in prison. The laws against this sort of trespass is quite strict, and today the magistrate didn't make any kind of judgment at all, but it was the initial hearing. How did you square that with your life, your own life?
Well, I mean, I don't think that there is a choice between sitting back and watching everything die versus getting a few convictions. I don't understand really how people don't start doing this sort of stuff if they're informed like the way people say they are on climate change. And I'm terrified of the system. It's a violent thing, and it does not treat people who question its legitimacy well. But also, I'm also not willing to stand by while this sort of injustice is happening, and protected by institutions like the one that we're standing at the front of. Yeah.
Okay. Well, look, the other institution is the media, and I was myself disappointed because I got a very good media press release from you, and someone phoned me, and I interviewed the first person who was on the tripod, and so it was very easy for journalists, I'm sure, to cover that story. But then it was covered by Newcastle Herald. Tiny bit I heard Radio National, and then they seem to have just said, oh, we've done that story, but you were doing it on a rolling basis. It got more and more impressive by the end. What's your feeling about the media? Why do they ignore it, or how can they ignore it? Because it's so colourful and so human, you're all young. It's a very interesting-looking story. Why didn't they cover it?
I mean, the media is a tool, and it's owned and operated by people who have a lot of vested interest in maintaining the status quo. Yeah, what we do is impressive. We can take hours or days of work off them a week when we're well organised. That really can do damage to their industry. But yeah, the media is definitely an unreliable friend to activism of any sort. We got several hundreds of thousands of views on Facebook and on other forms of social media outside the traditional media, which to me is a platform that we have. We get more from that platform than the mainstream media, because the mainstream media doesn't want to cover us. The ABC has a code of conduct that doesn't allow them to report on protests unless they're violent, is my understanding. And
how did you hear that?
I have no idea where I got that from, but I think it's from some work that I've done with another activist group, and looking through the ABC and the way that they report on things, they generally report on things if it's violent, not if it's anything else, because it's supposed to be an apolitical organisation, even though it's run by Murdoch Hack. They have a good excuse to not talk about the stuff we do. That being said, though, we got coverage in The Australian, we got coverage in Sydney Morning Herald, we got coverage... You know, we did get coverage in a lot of reasonably big newspapers, and this is the work of a reasonably small group of people. You know, we need more people to come and do this sort of stuff, and it can really take off.
Well, you're speaking to a Melbourne audience. A lot of the Stop Adani groups down there, Stop Coal groups, Stop Coal Seam Gas, they've had a moratorium on coal seam gas. You know, what do you want to say to them? It's obviously an ongoing big campaign.
Yeah. So I'm from Melbourne myself. I would invite people to come and find the closest piece of fossil fuel infrastructure to them where there's a campaign going, and really, really start targeting them. Well, sorry, maybe not the closest, but, you know, there are groups out there like us doing work against this. We're mobilising again up north to fight Adani. We've got a blockade on the ground up there. People are most welcome and encouraged to come up and participate. This doesn't necessarily mean taking part in direct action. You can be helping in pretty much whatever capacity you can. Even just being there provides us with support. Yeah, so there's a lot of... What's going to keep... There's going to be people staying in Newcastle to do some more work here on the largest coal pool in the world. And yeah, we have flat groups that are kind of starting all over the place.
Have I left anything out? Maybe my questions haven't hit the mark. What do you want to say, really? You speak through me to them.
Yeah, I've read a paper that a couple of months ago, actually, that spoke about the urgency of climate change. And the paper was written by a professor of atmospheric chemistry at Harvard University. And this is a person who found the holes in the ozone layer over Antarctica. So he's a well-established climate scientist. And he's saying that we have 5 years to end fossil fuels, period, or humans are likely to go extinct within the next couple of centuries. So to me, there is... Yeah, just really stress the point that there is... You know, the conventional ways of doing things are not working. We are going backwards. Keep trying, but also think about the ways in which you're trying. If you're using mechanisms of change that are set up by the people that don't want change to happen, you are very unlikely to see it be successful. There is, you know, millions of people in Australia who support more conventional political engagement but have similar political opinions to myself and the group that I'm part of. I think if people started doing more direct action and less conventional politics, lobbying, parliamentary stuff, I think we would get a lot further. And we need governments crack down on civil disobedience for a reason. It's very effective, and we need people to start to realise that doing what government says when they say don't do something, when they're actively fighting against their interests, is a stupid thing to do. When they tell the NGOs to not do direct action, otherwise you lose your DGR status, your responsibility is to keep doing direct action. We need people to be pushing the envelope more, because we are getting closer and closer to the cliff. And now is the time to pull out all stops.
Further comment?
Comment on Frontline Action on Coal as a group. We're an anti-hierarchical, consensus-driven group, so anyone's welcome to join our cause if they're interested in pursuing our ends. We have no bosses. We have no people telling us what is the way to win. We set our own agenda, and our doors are always open. We want more people to be involved in us. You know, this is, in my personal experience, the most supportive community I've ever experienced. We have a total diversity of people. We have people with incredibly young children. We have, you know, people in their 80s. You know, this is a group that would suit millions of people across this country.
Just thinking ahead of coal, let's just assume that it is going to phase out. All this action is going to work. It is a global movement, after all. You know, the tar sands, you know, there's plenty of people around doing it. Not enough, obviously. But just imagine that it comes to an end. Give it, say, well, you said 5 years. Well, give it 10 years. But what would that liberate in the way of other potential?
Oh, I mean, I think a large part of the problem with our worldview is that we still look at extraction and enslavement of people through the wages as a really containing thing. In a post-fossil fuel world, where people are going to be able to contribute to society more in a way that is constructive and in line with their beliefs, I am very hopeful that we can have a society that doesn't need to have a massive bureaucracy and government pretty much tying people down and making them behave rather than encouraging creativity and ingenuity. Yeah, I think the world that we see today will be looked back upon as dark age by people in 20 or 30 or 50 or 100 years time. And if it's not, the 100 years time is not going to exist. Like, that, you know, we have Scott Morrison at 1 degree of warming. Imagine what the world is going to look like at 4 or 7 degrees of warming, which is what we're facing by the end of this century. So, like, people really start taking this seriously. It is life, death, or cages for us in Australia and all over the world. Sorry.
As someone said to me, it just attach 4 degrees of warming to every sentence you make with people. Just make them think about it. I'd like to thank the Frontline Action on Coal group, who I met up in Newcastle. Their media was excellent. They were very professional about it, and I appreciated that they had done this action with great care and protection for all of them, for themselves and for anyone involved. If you want to support them or join them, you can contact them at FLAC Newcastle at protonmail.com. That's FLAC, FLAC, Newcastle, at protonmail.com. Their media phone number is 0457 1133 80. Also, there's a group that's to support those who are going to face legal charges called FLAC Legal at protonmail.com. Many thanks to them, to Barlin and his mum, to Max and to the Knitting Nanas. My name is Vivian Langford, and this has been recorded for the Beyond Zero Emissions show at Radio 3CR.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
That was radio journalist Vivian Langford with an on-the-spot report from Newcastle, Australia, the world's largest coal shipping port. I'll put links to her Beyond Zero show, podcast, and group in my own show blog at ecoshock.org. Thank you, Vivian. That's it for Radio EcoShock. Please join us again next week. I'm Alex Smith, saying thank you for listening and caring about our world.
We shall fight them on the beaches. We shall fight them on the shore. They will bring us exploitation. We'll bring them their class war. And we'll lock down to the gates as they're spreading vicious lies. They want to dominate the world, and we see through their disguise. If they'd have one big multinational with their corporate flag unfurled, searching everywhere for the lowest wages in the world, then we'll have one big union from Melbourne to Prague to Seattle town. Wherever they may go, we will shut them down. We'll shut them down. We'll shut them down. We will shut them down. Got the chorus yet? That's it. That's And CNN will spread the lies. This is just how it's gotta be. Well, they can have their CNN, 'cause we've got our IMC. And we'll tell the truth quite clearly, though they don't wanna hear it. And they'll try to stop our broadcasts, 'cause the truth is that they fear it. We'll shut them down. We'll shut them down.